because that's S-H-I-T. That spells shit, we're aware, and I know that's fucking weird, but listen to this shit.
Hello, listener. Hello, friends. Welcome to Shit. Thanks so much for tuning in. This show today is very special to me. It's obviously a play on the phrase, and now a word from our sponsors. But this is an actual conversation I had with my sponsor, who is currently guiding me through the 12 steps in a little somewhat unknown program here called Marijuana Anonymous. Who would have thought? They have it for weed. They surely do. I guess it's not that surprising, but it sort of is at the same time, right? Weed has become legal in many parts of the United States, finally. And, you know, cannabis has done a shit ton medically for folks. And, I mean, there's so many things that cannabis just has such a rich history. And I will always have a fondness for it. But daddy had to quit that shit because, well, I was obsessed. AKA, I would say addicted. Now, it's funny because anything can be addictive, in my opinion. But, I mean, it's not just my opinion. And look, it's the truth. Let's just be real. We can be addicted to anything. And, you know, weed is not exempt from that, for the love of God. I mean, it is a mind-altering plant, you know. And yes, it's, you know, for years I made excuses of, well, it's not really a drug, it's a plant, and it's better than any other substance that I could be doing. That's very mind-altering, especially in comparison with alcohol. And, you know, I justified my usage mainly because I felt the need to justify it because something didn't feel quite right, and I think that I had really been denying that little gnawing feeling for many, many years. I didn't even start smoking weed until I was in my early 20s. I was nearly finishing college, and I had avoided it and avoided it and avoided it and thought, nope, that's not me. Nope, not doing that. Nope, that's a drug. You know, I'm better than that. And then eventually I just got really curious, and when I was ready, I said, let's do it. Let's just fire it up. Let's see what's going on. And I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool that I did it at my own accord and not, you know, by being convinced to do it by friends. And, you know, slowly it grew on me and it grew on me and it grew on me. And, you know, I'd been smoking it recreationally, aka a few times a week for about, you know, over 10 years. And it wasn't until I got a job working at a really awesome and reputable cannabis dispensary in Los Angeles a couple years ago that, you know, I had all of this free product. They had so much great shit. And it's like, well, I better try this stuff. And I went from like a few times a week smoker to a nightly smoker. And not just nightly, I mean, sometimes daily. I never woke up and smoked in the mornings. I wasn't a wake and baker. I'm a waker baker. But the thing that is interesting about addiction is a lot of times we have preconceived notions about what addiction looks like. And the fact is that it just doesn't look the same for everyone. You know? I mean, shit, there are, you know, it's easy to notice someone if they're maybe hammered drunk all the time, to say, you know, that person's an alcoholic. But then there are alcoholics who live fully functioning lives. And I think, you know, the thing that really distinguishes any addiction is just the stranglehold you feel that it has over you. And, you know, over a year ago, February 2020, I sort of conceded, you know, something had been pinching me just gently, just gentle pinches for many years, that maybe it wasn't really serving me, but I justified it because I loved it and it was fun. And what was the big deal? I was only doing it a few times a week. I was being safe. It wasn't affecting this, that, or the other. You know, it's so funny because when you have addiction, when you have that addictive brain, it really doesn't matter how often you do something, but it's how often are you thinking about this thing? How often is this thing affecting you, you know, just because you're obsessing over it? And I thought of weed all the time when I wasn't smoking it. It wasn't like, oh, look, here's a doobie. I'm at a party. Let me take a hit. It was, no, let me, I need weed. That's what I do. That's my thing now. It's fun, and it would amplify things for me, and it was great. And then I think eventually it really dawned on me, like, and I, by eventually, I literally mean over a year ago, I can't smoke anymore if I want to do the things that I want to do in my life. And it took me a long time to finally understand that, because I saw plenty of people being productive and creative and living out their dreams who also happen to smoke weed. And it was like, why can't I do that? Why can't I do that? I can do that. Why can't I do both? And, you know, it was just, sometimes it's just an inner knowing that something isn't really working. And, you know, getting sober was definitely, it was definitely one of the best decisions I've ever made. And there's been countless amounts of growing pains and things as a result, but ultimately I feel like my life is manageable. I feel like my life is very manageable now. I feel like there were things that I avoided and distracted myself from, feelings, financial things, personal things that just I didn't know how to deal with. I had a lot of feelings, and weed just made me happy-go-lucky and silly and stupid, and I could forget all that shit. And what was the big deal? You know? But that's the funny thing about weed. It doesn't really feel like a big deal because it's weed, you know? You're not gonna OD on weed. You're probably not gonna wake up, you know, in a gutter. I feel like that sounds so naive when I say that, as if I'm talking about, what does that even mean? You know, unless I ate 10,000 calories worth of snacks because I got so baked that I fell asleep, walking home. But that's my spiel. This is a conversation with my sponsor. I refer to her as Claire in this episode. Her name isn't Claire, but for the sake of anonymity, you know, she felt more comfortable being referred to as Claire. And she didn't choose Claire. I chose Claire. And she said, Claire is good. And I said, really? And she said, yeah. So I said, okay. Alrighty, Claire. Oh boy. So I hope that you find this informative and interesting, and that you learn something. And maybe that you'll get some comfort and peace out of it. So without further ado, this is my fifth interview episode, Here she is, my sponsor. Oh my God, Claire. Thank you so much for doing this. This is fantastic. I love this. And I'm so excited to be having a conversation with a human that's not myself, but not just any human. Claire, you are my sponsor.
Yes.
My sponsor. And, yes. You know, I already gave people an intro a little bit to, you know, how we met and all of that. So I'm just going to ask you a lot of questions. I really want to know your input. I think this could be very helpful for people listening, whether they do or don't, you know, struggle with addiction. I think that I know that for me, when I tell people that I'm in Marijuana Anonymous, I always feel like a big goober. I always feel like a moron. Let me give you one more adjective. I always feel like such a twat. I it's just like, what? Man, they have that, you know? And it's like, yeah, they do. You know, meanwhile, in the country, weed is so much more finally, you know, normalized and accepted and whatnot. But we'll get into that in a second. I want to start off with this question, Claire. You ready?
I'm ready.
Why are you so awesome?
Oh, for crying out loud. I would just, you know, I'll just take that in for a moment and say that the reason I'm so awesome is because I'm adorable. That's number one.
And I wasn't going to say anything, but you are.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm adorable and, you know, I work at this, like, right. This doesn't just happen. I don't just wake up awesome. I work at it and I put a lot of time and energy into being my best self. So I appreciate that you see me that way. And yeah, and I'm just going to keep on keeping on it in that regard because I do want to be the best person I can be. So,
wow. God, that was incredible. Thank you for that. You know, that reminds me of a quote in my favorite movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, where the character of Jay says to Steve Carell's character, "Yo, you think this was an accident? This is all premeditated, partner." And he's basically like showing his face saying, you know, I don't just look this good on accident. So thank you for that. So that was anything to quote the 40-Year-Old Virgin. Next question is, what's your favorite snack?
That's an excellent question. And it changes based on my mood. I'm super happy to eat an apple with almond butter. That is super delicious. I like, you know, when I'm feeling indulgent, I'll have cheese and wheat crackers. You know, the dairy and the wheat combination is always a delicious and savory treat. And then, you know, when I'm feeling like, you know, a snack needs to be a hamburger, then I'm going to eat a hamburger. Like, so, I mean, that's a rare occasion, but, yeah, I think those are my, and then, oh, of course, always like yogurt maybe, and a little like fresh blueberries and some sort of nuts and maple syrup on there. Delicious.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. First of all, I'm kidding. And all of those snacks were just incredible. You put so much thought into all of those. When you said dairy and wheat, the first thing I thought of was, wow, I'm not having any kind of movement down south for about a week. That was just unnecessary, but it's the truth. Good snack choices. All right, let's get into some deeper shit, you know, some deeper snacks. I don't know why I'm acting like this. I'm acting like a total, I'm not going to say it. Okay. Do you believe that you agreeing to sponsor me was divine intervention? Because I do.
That's a great question. I've never thought of it in that context. Well, yeah. I mean, why not? Like I do tend to, I'm going to jump on this train. And then the reason why is because I do believe that, you know, I am being guided in this journey. So, you know, there really aren't any accidents. There are no mistakes. There are no, you know, anything that's like beautiful in my life, like my relationship with you, is something that was supposed to happen for me and is a lesson for me and a gift to me. So yeah, I'll just say yeah to that. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I love that. Was a good answer. Okay, great. All right, so I'll keep you as my sponsor.
And, okay.
Wonderful. No, thank you. That means a lot to me. And I completely concur. All right. This is where it gets interesting, because, you know, a lot of people don't know that MA exists. I mean, I think that you could take any drug, any any food, anything, and probably put an anonymous afterwards, because, I mean, we do. We're human beings, and we, you know, we want that. We want that pleasure. We want that dopamine. We want all that shit. So anyhow, getting back to it, when did you find out that MA exists, and what year did you start going to meetings?
I don't recall exactly when I learned about MA. It was probably somewhere around 5 to 10 years before I decided to go, because I did think about, like, at certain times in my life, well, that, you know, this drug wasn't useful for me anymore, but I kept doing it, right? So my life, as many for many addicts, was not really, there wasn't a tremendous amount of wreckage happening in my life, but there was definitely this low meaning. You know, to explain that to people who are listening, it, you know, alcoholism or an alcohol, when you think of addiction and alcohol addiction or alcoholism, you know, many people think of people who really lose everything, right? Their financial life goes to ruin, their relationships go to ruin, their careers, you know, because alcohol is, you know, is pretty intense in that regard. It can really do a number on you. Marijuana can do a number on you as well, but it's much more insidious. So the effect was not as externally obvious as it was to my, like, soul and my spirit and my happiness and my joy. But I did know, you know, probably 5 to 10 years before I went to a meeting that it existed. And I can't really tell you exactly how, because I don't remember I knew that, but I can tell you that I probably looked it up. Like, oh, you know, is there a place to go for people who, you know, keep smoking dope, but, like, really don't like it anymore, you know? And then my first meeting was on January 5th, 2013. So I remember it very well.
Wow.
Excuse me, January 3rd, 2013.
Wow. Okay. So you, like you just said, so you knew about it about 10 years prior to going to your first meeting.
Yeah, maybe 5 years. I don't even remember, but yeah. I knew about it. Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds about right for somebody who's smoking a lot of weed. So I'm just kidding, Claire. I'm not kidding. You know, I'm just trying to lighten. I can't see Claire's face right now, guys. So I don't know if she's upset with me or if I sound like a smart, and I'm just making these things up. This is total projection. Claire has a history of, you know, comedy and things like that, like I do. So I should know better. I just, you know, I'm very codependent. So anyhow, okay. So you described it a little bit, but can you tell us a little bit more about your pot usage up until that point? Like, and also, how did it affect or enhance, you know, your life and or creativity? I know there were a lot of and ors in there, but.
Sure. So, you know, my using started when I was 12 years old and continued for 35 years after that. So it was a pretty long journey. And I used it, you know, regularly when I was a teenager. I had access to it. It was, like, you know, down the hall to the right, you know, walk into my parents' bedroom, open the dresser drawer on the bottom, you know, rummage through their things and find it, like, it was right there. So I had pot, you know, around me and accessible to me, you know, from pretty much the time I started smoking it, and continued to smoke it throughout my teenage years, my 20s, 30s, 40s, until I got sober. And, you know, did it enhance my creativity? No, I don't think so. I mean, I've been sober long enough to know what it feels like to access my creativity without any kind of, mind altering substance. And so for me, I can say hands down, frankly, that, my creativity is accessible to me without any outside help. And if I can say one thing about, like, I had some good ideas when I was stoned. I just never remembered them. So, you know, now are the quality of my ideas as good as they were then? Yeah, they are. You know, my creativity has shifted. I'm in a new space creatively. I'm applying my creativity in a new way. But, you know, I'm no longer like, you know, trying to write comedy and be funny and all that kind of thing. I mean, I'm relatively hysterical, you know, if you get to know me, but at this very moment, my creativity is manifesting in other ways, like, you know, so yeah, I mean, I suppose it worked, but it's no better, certainly no better than it is now.
Right. And that, wouldn't you say, I mean, there's a real element of denial in that too. I mean, if we happen to be very creative and we're smoking, you know, a lot of weed, and listen, I've seen people do it. That's the thing that would always boggle my mind. I've seen people, you know, get stoned daily and be extremely creative. And I always wondered why I couldn't do that. And did you stop doing comedy around the time that you got sober? And yeah.
No, I stopped doing comedy years before that. Okay. So yeah, no, I think the ship had already sailed in terms of, like, I don't think that's actually the right metaphor. So let me reframe that. You know, I had done stand up for like 5 years pretty regularly. And, you know, in that time frame, you know, I was definitely living, my head was in a creative space a lot, but I wasn't really able to focus on or excavate or like determine like what was I really trying to do with the comedy. So it was just sort of this kind of endless loop of, like, you know, trying to get really good and then losing steam and then trying to get, you know, work, put the work in. And then, and, you know, part of that was just ultimately, I don't think it was the right fit for my, you know, creative life. Right. So, but, you know, by the time I got sober, which was when I was 47, I was not really thinking about stand up at that point anymore. Yeah. It had been, I'm trying to do the math in my head while we're talking, but like, I started in like 99, 2000, I did it till 2005. You know, at that point, you know, I think like 5, 6, 7 years, you know, went by since I stopped doing stand up before I got sober. So,
okay. Very interesting. Was there a specific tipping point or conversation or experience that you had, that made you realize, oh shit, this is a problem?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. You know, I can't remember the timing because I was stoner, and I had an argument with my sister, and during that argument, I made a conscious decision to just like unleash my anger in a way that I never had, at least in my mind, unleashed it before. And what came out was so horrifying and so venomous and really led me to feel like a tremendous amount of shame that I just knew, I guess, instinctually, and my intuition was saying, like, yeah, there's something really wrong with all of that resentment that you're holding on to. I mean, it was like decades old. And so, yeah, I was like pretty clear at that point that, like, even though I didn't make the connection between that anger and that resentment and my addiction, it was definitely a tipping point for me that led me to realize that my spiritual life was just, had been unattended to. And is that even a word? But it was, it needed some love, mm-hmm. right? It needed some love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, how much had you been even valuing up until that point, your spiritual life? Because that's what's so interesting to me is, I mean, I realize that this is, you know, this can get very layered, but I mean, how did you feel, you know, spiritually? What did you put your, and I don't mean to make this, you know, into a God topic, but what did you put your faith or hope, just even about being a human, into when you were younger?
here we go. You ready? Okay. So I always, you know, fancied myself a spiritual human being, right?
Yep.
Just because I think that's who I wanted to be. And, you know, I think I believed it before I became it, right? So, you know, don't hate the player, like hate the game, right? So she wants to become a spiritual person. I'm talking about myself. You know, I would, and I wasn't particularly religious in that, you know, I was like, you know, I was into the Jewish faith, and, you know, I'd grown up with, you know, relatively, you know, modest Jewish identity, but I really had no God consciousness in my life. But I did, in some regards, you know, even though I don't think I practice spirituality in the way that, of course, I practice it now, of course, right? Which is kind of a silly like thing to say, but it's true. It sounds silly. I don't know when I say it out loud. But I just, you know, I basically didn't really tap into my spirituality, but I can tell you that, you know, I did yoga. I drank shakes with green juice in them and spinach, you know what I mean? I think every once in a while I took a deep breath, like every week or two, you know, you know? So like, I mean, I think I wanted to be more, you know, perceived as spiritual and Zen. I mean, I think that's why I smoked pot to begin with, right? Because it chilled me the fuck out, excuse my French, or at least it did externally, because, you know, it slowed my mind down initially. And then, you know, as it started to wear off, that spinning, you know, ruminating, continual like loop of, you know, just thoughts, you know, were out of my control. And that's what, you know, that's what initially pot was for me, was to try to get a grip on that. But what I've been able to access in my sobriety and in my recovery more specifically is a way to mitigate those thoughts and to eliminate, you know, the ones that really don't serve me. So that's what my spiritual journey is about. It's like allowing right now more, you know, more intuition really to come in. However, you know, I mean, I call it a higher power, but whatever you want to call it, you can call it like, but for me, it's just allowing that higher power and that intuition to guide me, you know?
For sure. I call mine Gloria.
Right. Right.
Gloria to God.
I heard somebody refer to their higher power as Harry Styles, and I thought that was like awesome. So like, whatever it is for you, you know, everybody gets to, there is no dogma in, you know, Marijuana Anonymous. You get to pick whatever you want to pick.
All right. This is a confession moment. I'm gay, as the day is long. Mm-hmm. I have a pretty, pretty substantial crush on Harry Styles.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. He's gorgeous. Yeah. What are you going to say? He's got this little gender fluid thing going on. I like his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I like things hairy. I'm so sorry. That's actually not even true. Okay.
He reminds me. He's like the David Bowie, yes, of my generation, yeah, you know.
Which is pretty, you know, that's a statement. But, I mean, who the hell else is? Who else is?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Okay.
I do.
Yes.
I do.
Yes. No, and I love all of that. When you, this is where I'm so curious. I know that for me, and I mean, of course, I only started attending Marijuana Anonymous meetings around the time that I stopped smoking weed, and then the pandemic happened, and I didn't bother to try and find any online. And then I finally did back in June. That's when we met. What were your initial judgments, if any? I'm just assuming that there had to have been some judgments about MA and the people that you were going to meet or were meeting.
My judgments were nothing but wonderful experiences. I mean, I did not question my, you know, relationship with the program at all. Like the minute I stepped into a meeting and realized that I earned my seat there and I belonged there, like I was open to the journey. So for me, you know, I can't really share with you anything that was outside of like awesomeness for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was ready to get sober though. You know, I was ready for a new experience. I was ready to, you know, open my mind up to something different than what had, you know, been happening. So for me, it was like, you know, I wasn't a person who was like into groups. I didn't like, you know, it's not that I didn't like people. I mean, I said I'd like people on the outside. I was like, I'm a people person, right? But inside I was like, I don't know if I want to be associated with any group where I need to show up on a regular basis or commit, you know?
Yes.
I was not a brownie. I was not a Girl Scout. You know what I mean? I didn't want to like be in a book group. I don't want to be I wasn't a sorority sister. You know, I was a lone wolf and, you know, and to some degree still am, in that, like, you know, I'm shaking that persona. I mean, I'm learning about myself every day, and that persona no longer really like aligns with my identity. But, you know, I walked into those meetings and I was like, there's artists, there are people, you know, that I related to immediately, that, you know, there's a lot of love in those rooms. You know, I got to interpret the experience, and I was encouraged from the beginning to interpret the experience on my own terms. So, you know, I didn't have anything, like I wasn't resisting the ride. Like I was like, I'm here, I'm good. Like this is, let me see what I can get out of this. So, you know, and that's different. Everyone has their own experience in this journey. Like for me though, you know, I had been smoking dope for 35 years. Like I was like really, really clear that marijuana was not a drug that I wanted to do or be associated with or be around anymore. You know, it was no longer my best friend. It had turned on me. And so when I was there and there were actually people there who I could just be myself with and like just like say the thing out loud that I had never been able to say out loud, and nobody at least outwardly judged me or shamed me around it. You know, I had carried a lot of shame up until that point. So for me to be in a room where I was like, yeah, you know, I used to smoke pot in a very like cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs way. People like, yeah, I totally get that. Like me too. I was like, oh, right on. Okay. I'm home. Like this is where I belong, you know? And so I immediately, talk about like higher power, divine intervention. I mean, that was it for me. Like I got sober immediately. I mean, I got sober and never craved marijuana again, period. End of story. Like done. I was done. So for me, I didn't have anything to do with that, because if it were up to me, probably like on my own, you know, on my own terms, like if I had never showed up there, I can tell you that I would have smoked pot again. And I probably, you know, would still be struggling with it. So, you know, at this stage of the game, I was just like, I felt free right away.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. There were so many times when I wanted to interject while you were speaking to throw in just a very silly joke, just in conjunction with some of the things you were saying, but I didn't want to interrupt your flow. That being said, I don't know why I just said that out loud, because I didn't say anything, and none of it's, if I was going to make a Cocoa Puffs joke, you said you're cuckoo, and I was absolutely, oh God, okay. It's okay, Bethany. You're doing fine. So mad at myself. Okay. This I don't know when I transformed into that Chris Farley character when he's talking to famous actors and he just stupid and he starts beating himself. I love that. I love everything you just said, and I really can relate to it at probably about 98% of that, because I think it's really amazing when I'm in these meetings, and I see people who just aren't very open, and they're kind of there. I mean, they're obviously there for a reason, but they're still not sold, and they're still, and that's actually that when I see people like that, that's amazing to me, because I think what kind of strength. I mean, they're clearly fighting this. They're fighting this on some level, or they're really, really struggling to stay. So, because for me, similar, and we have very, we have different experiences as far as like the length of time go. But when I realized that I needed to be done, I realized it too. And that was right before I went to my first MA meeting, So it's always amazing to me when people are actively still having cravings and going to try. I think that's really admirable. So, and of course, not discounting your situation or mine, I think that's, I just so interesting how stories go for everyone. And I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
When I first went into my, I literally did a couple in-person MA meetings, and then the pandemic started, and those were the only in-person meetings I'd gone to. But the couple that I went to, I'm not going to lie to you. I walked in, and I had already, I've been in Al-Anon for a couple of years, so I was familiar with that kind of set, the 12 steps. And I walked in there, and I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, even from the time I was young, I have had, I talk about this with internalized homophobia, but even with that internalized judgment about drug use, I was very much against weed. I didn't even smoke it until I was almost 23 years old. And so I kind of stepped into that meeting knowing that it was probably going to benefit me. But when I kind of looked around, I saw a bunch, it was mostly men. And they all just kind of looked like they rolled out of bed. And I thought, oh, Jesus, is this how it's going to be like for every meeting? And I feel bad saying that, but it's just like, I wanted, I kept meeting people who seemed that marijuana had really just taken over their lives. And it seemed like a very low energy type of place, and then I sat there and I started to listen, and get the fuck over myself. And I started to really hear some beautiful things. I'm like, oh yeah, I can relate to that. Okay. And it's just amazing to me, all of the prejudgments I really had.
Well, if I may, I just want to say, like, when I got lucky, because like my first meeting was, at a very, at the Gay and Lesbian Center in West Hollywood, on Manhattan. It was a really small meeting. My second meeting, though, was at a place called St. Bede's Church, which the church is still there, but the meeting no longer exists in person at that location. But it is a meeting that had been in Los Angeles for probably 25 years. And so it was a notoriously robust fellowship with a lot of people who had a lot of time and a lot of recovery. And so I walked into like a meeting where people were smiling and joyful. And there were, of course, people that were like, pissed off and angry that they were there, but there was like the gamut, right? So I just walked into like a room full of like a lot of open-hearted people who embraced me like immediately. And then subsequent to that, like I've been in meetings all over the country. I've traveled. I've been to meetings in Chicago. You know, I've been to meetings in Philadelphia, New York, everywhere. You know, I traveled a lot for work. So, you know, and I always try to squeeze in a meeting when I'm on the road or when I was on the road. And, you know, I've been in many, many meetings where, you know, I was like not as certainly, you know, I didn't get that joyful hit that I got from the meeting that I was, what I refer to as my home meeting. So, you know, we all, you know, we all have like different experiences for sure. But like you said, like listening to what's going on is, and knowing that like when you're in a meeting, it's not, and this is something that I think comes with time, but it's not only about, you know, what am I going to get out of it? Is that if I show up to a meeting, I'm being of service, inherently being of service just by showing up. Because, you know, without the people who show up, there is no meeting. So, you know, my point of view has shifted away from like, what am I going to get out of this is to, you know, more to what can I bring to it? You know, how am I going to contribute to the recovery in this meeting? I mean, that's where I am in my recovery now. So, but yeah, you know, I got lucky, girl. I got lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds really amazing. Which meetings, which cities, or just out of curiosity, did meetings stand out for you? And now we're playing a game of like, which city has the best marijuana addicts? But I mean,
well, LA is where my peeps are, yeah. Right? Because that's where I live. But I, you know, I was in a meeting. I was in Chicago. I was working the Chicago Auto Show, which is something I used to do, and. You know, I went to a meeting like, and when you're in another city, I don't know if you're, but like, I didn't know where I was. I'm like, oh, there's a meeting here, right? I'm going to get in the rental car, the van. I'm going to be like, hey, everybody, I need the car tonight. I'm going to go to a meeting, right? Or whatever. And, you know, you don't know where, like, I wasn't well oriented to the city. So I ended up in a meeting that was like full of, you know, people who had also addictions to many other substances other than marijuana, heroin, alcohol, you know, crack cocaine. And it was in an area of town that was, some people would consider, you know, a dangerous area of town. Like I'm sure that like there was a lot mm-hmm. of crime in that area, mm-hmm. right? I got to say that like that meeting in particular, I mean, it's like I can remember like where I was sitting, you know, in that room. And it was like, first of all, it was like people of all different backgrounds, ethnicities, races, ages, you know, not that many people really. I think it was maybe only about 10 or 15 people. But anyway, the bottom line is like, it was really like meetings are good if you are willing to be present in the meeting. Like, you know, what I get out of a meeting is up to me. You know, it's not up to whether or not the cookies are delicious or the coffee is good.
Okay, because that was going to be my next question about which city had the best coffee, but continue.
Right. You know, so yeah, I mean, I remember going to a meeting on the south side of in Philadelphia, and I walked in. It was like full. I mean, this is the thing. Wherever you go to a meeting, you are welcome. You are loved. You are embraced, right? I mean, this is a fellowship. It transcends, you know, I mean, in my mind, it transcends, you know, age. It transcends substance. You know, I mean, I've gone to Alcoholics America. By the way, that was probably an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You know, the Marijuana Anonymous is not a big, it's not as nearly as big a fellowship as Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, for me, I identify as an alcoholic as well. So, you know, it's the ism, right? It's not the marijuana. It's not the alcohol. It's not the porn. It's not the gambling. It's not the shopping. It's the ism. It's that, you know, we get hooked emotionally and physically with an obsession of the mind and an allergy, what we refer to as an allergy of the body, which means that these substances, whether it's alcohol or marijuana or gambling, whatever it is, we interact with those things, those external substances, those mind altering substances. If you want to consider, you know, gambling that you can, but in a way that other people do not. So the bottom line is it just doesn't matter what it is. It's just, we all we all love each other and belong together. And that's, I'm sticking to it. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. Like, not everybody feels that way about, you know, this fellowship, but for me, I'm welcome wherever I go because I know I belong. I feel welcome and I belong, period.
That's yeah. It. Well, that's completely true. Everything is what we really make of it, but that it is really amazing about any anonymous meeting. I mean, of course, you know, you can find, just like anything in life, you can find yourself in situations that don't feel as great, or, you know, who the hell knows? I mean, look, just like any meeting, I'm sure you could probably find an anonymous meeting that where, you know, people are maybe very clicky or judgy, but in my experience, there's so little judgment and so much judgment or so little judgment that people, you know, love to share about their own judgments or their fears of other judgments of, you know, and it's just this, it's incredibly, I found it to be incredibly supportive, you know, and what's so great about these meetings, there's zero pressure. I mean, everybody wants, I mean, I know damn well that, you know, when I'm sitting in those rooms, I am rooting for other people. I am hoping that they stay sober. Of course I am. But at the end of the day, I just want them to be okay. I think it's kind of amazing, even when people come back into meetings after having relapse after relapse, like that always kind of blows me away because I've got that, you know, perfectionism, of course, is vast a lot of the time with these scenarios. And I know for me, I would just, the idea of me smoking again would just feels so terrible. You know, like I'm kind of the mindset of, well, I will never do that again, you know, and I try to catch myself, obviously, because we can't ever say, we don't really know. We just can have the best of intentions, but when we do practice being authentically ourselves and knowing what I think our souls need, obviously we're much less likely to do things that are going to conflict with that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, here's the thing about this fellowship is that, you know, we do this one day at a time is what we say, right? It's part of our literature. It's part of our messaging, you know, and everybody comes to this fellowship with a different story, right? I mean, but then again, we all share something very familiar and very deep and very personal, which is addiction. And so, you know, when people show up to these meetings, they're going to have a ton of different experiences, you know, and they're all valid, right? And they're all, you know, welcome, right? Like the beautiful thing about recovery is what I've learned to do in recovery is I stay out of other people's story. Like I don't need to be involved in what somebody else is doing or thinking or feeling, you know, all I know is I'm just going to, you know, we have this notion of principles before personalities. It's like, I bring my principles to the table, like, and that's, I hold myself to a higher power and to my principles before, you know, I get involved in what other people are thinking or feeling. Now, mind you, I mean, look, that sounds like perfectly ideal. It's not always been the case. Like sometimes I go to a meeting, I'm like, that was really annoying, whatever. That thing was really annoying. But for the most part, like what I've learned to do then is look at, you know, well, what was my role in that? You know, my role in that was like, you know, I'm getting irritated. I'm reacting to something that, you know, is not about me. Right. It's not about me. So, and that's the thing. It's like, we get to take ourselves, I mean, out of everything. I mean, it's just like exhausting when you think about like all of the times that I thought that I was like, you know, the center of the universe and the world revolved around me. And that, you know, I was like, you know, causing people to act in a certain way or behave, or, you know, I was responding to people's behavior. Bottom line is I don't even know. I'm probably going down the rabbit hole here, but I think about my relationship with people and their experience in a very different way than I used to. I'm out of it. I stand out of it. Like there's a boundary now, Right. People get to experience this on their time frame, in their way. It's very personal. You know, I'm just going to worry about me and what I can do.
Exactly. You know? And I, you know, admittedly, if I hadn't been doing Al-Anon for a year and a half leading up to me being in LA, I really don't think that I would be there yet. I think just because, I don't know, my concerns with other people and really wanting to control situations and control people, you know, and of course, and it sounds so, it sounds so displeasing and, you know, malicious, but of course it's like, for me, well, I want to protect somebody, you're right. Or I want the best for someone. So I'm going to tell them how to live or give them, you know, just a shit ton of advice that they didn't ask for. And one of the biggest things that just being in recovery has taught me is it's true. Everybody has their own time frame, and people won't hear you unless they're really open to it. They can't hear you. We could talk and talk and talk. I mean, I remember just even in my 20s, and I always prided myself on being able to give really good advice. And there would be some times when I thought, man, I am killing it with this monologue on trying to change somebody. And it just goes in one ear and out the other. And I don't realize it, you know, and it's.
Yeah. I mean, and me too. I mean, I used to subscribe to, like, you know, unsolicited advice. Here's the thing. People don't want to be held hostage with your advice against their will. Yes. Right. They just don't. Like, you know, and typically, you know, especially adult. I mean, when I say your advice, I'm talking about my advice too, right? I don't want to hold somebody hostage with my, like, opinion against their will. I mean, I've gotten much more, you know, aware of that. And, you know, when we learn as far as I'm concerned, this is just my opinion, in recovery, and it's not just recovery, it's my journey into adulthood, you know, as a 55-year-old woman. It's like, you know, I want to be curious. Like, you started this podcast with, like, you know, I'm curious. You said, I'm curious. That's kind of the way I approach my relationships now, because, you know, I like when we ask someone a question about themselves, how they're doing, you know, what they think about things, just like you're doing in this podcast. It's like they feel heard when they can answer on their terms rather than, like, and this is kind of convoluted, but people come to their own conclusions when you ask them questions and you're curious with them. You know, that's where, like, the critical thinking and the problem solving come from, asking open-ended questions where people get an opportunity to think through the answer for themselves. So, you know, that to me is, I mean, although sponsorship has an element of, like, suggested, you know, behavior that we do communicate to our sponsees. Like, we suggest that if you want to get sober and you want to stay sober and you want to recover, that you do these things X, Y, and Z. You know, in day-to-day life, like, people don't want to be told what to do. Ask them about themselves. Stop telling. Start asking.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of like, just like you're doing here. Yes.
Well, I'm going to tell you what to say next, Claire. So, I mean, one second, I'm going to send you a text, and then I'm going to have you answer it this way. Okay, here we go. Okay, I'm a fool. So I have a couple of questions that, if somebody asked me this question, I would do that thing where there's it just doesn't feel like there's a straight answer here. That being said, I want to know, in your opinion, if you will, can someone smoke weed every day and not be an addict?
Oh, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Great answer.
I can.
Right.
I can't. Excuse me. I can't. You know,
Claire, put the bong down.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's a no for me. You know, this is the thing about addiction. That, you know, I don't get to tell anybody, nor am I interested in telling anybody that they're an addict. You know, it is, you know, no human power can relieve our addiction as part of our literature, right? No human power. So that means like, I can't tell you what I think you are. It has to be, you know, it has to come from you. Yeah. You know, I mean, I just, if you're smoking dope every day, my question is, you know, and you don't think it's a problem, then my question would be, why don't you stop and see, you know, what would you think about stopping and seeing what happens? Like, that would be like this experience, you know, if you were curious about whether or not you were an addict, I just say, you know, put it down. I mean, if you want to get wasted, you know, take no mind altering substances and just like live life. Like you want to be decimated by, like, you want to experience like highs and lows, like just be sober. You know what I mean? Like, you know,
yeah,
you know, that's right. How I see it.
No, I think that's very truthful and honest. And I know that it's hard for me to trust anyone who I might be looking to for real insight when they're able to give cold, hard, clear answers, because you're right. It is just not a clear thing. It's, you know, you kind of follow it up with a question. Well, do you know, again, right.
Well, yeah, I don't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry, but we do have a list of questions. Like, if someone's curious about whether or not they're an addict, there are a list of questions on marijuana-anonymous.org that they can access, and they can read those questions and answer them. Yeah. Right. And like, I was a really good student. I got all the questions right. Right. Yeah. Because I was an addict. I am an addict. Right. So I answered and I was like, oh yeah, that applies to me. Oh yeah. All these 12 questions, these right. all apply to me. So, you know, that's available if right. you're curious.
No, it is curious. Very helpful to know. And then this question, I feel like it is maybe a little easier, if you will. Can someone be an addict even if they don't smoke weed every day?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, my opinion.
Or any substance,
opinion.
Right, of choice, right?
Yeah, it's not what happens. It's not how often you smoke or drink. It's what happens when you do. So, you know, in our program, what we subscribe to as a fellowship is that there are two elements that categorize someone as addicted. One is an obsession of the mind. And the second is what we refer to as an allergy of the body. And to make sure that that's clear, I'll explain, you know, the allergy of the body. And this is, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous literature, which is, you know, Marijuana Anonymous is an offshoot of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that, you know, when you drink or when you smoke, the question that I would, you know, suggest you ask yourself if you're curious about whether you're an addict or not is there some sort of insatiable craving that happens? Meaning, you know, are you spending your energy at that point? You know, I'll have one more. No, I don't want another one. Maybe I'll have one more hit. No, I'm going to do another drink. I can't have another drink. It's tomorrow. I got to go to work. All right, I'll have it. And then, I mean, that's just like a modest example of, like, you know, the head games. And then when you drink, you're like, I really want another one, but I'm not going to. I really want more. I'm going to have more. You know, the body starts to crave. There's a craving. Like, I had a craving for marijuana. Like, I would smoke, you know, dope. One hit is too many. 4,000 hits was not enough. Right? So, that's kind of how yes. I see, and I'll just go out on a limb and just say we see what addiction is. So it's not about how often, really. It's about what happens when
and,
you do.
And you know, and it's a lot of people don't quite understand that. You know, if people don't deal with substance addiction, or at least think they don't, you know, people think a lot of times they think it looks a certain way, right? It's very easy to tell when somebody, you know, is falling down drunk all the time. Okay, you know, that person's an alcoholic or, you know, but, you know, for people who smoke, you know, a bunch of weed, it's like, oh, well, they're just a pothead, right? Different consequences, if you will. And I mean, for me, it just hearing you say that, believe it or not, it just brings me a lot of comfort, because it does remind me, I mean, I have, you know, close family members that were just dumbfounded when I say, you know, I got sober because of weed. And a lot of them said, well, what do you mean? Well, I didn't realize that it was that bad. I didn't realize it was that bad. Right. That was the phrase. I didn't realize it was such a problem. And right. Because it looks differently to other people. And of course, for me underneath, I mean, to others, I mean, anybody who I ever smoked weed with friend wise would say to me it was so obvious, but to me, I really thought it was me being so unique. And because I'm so funny that when I would smoke, I would just get amplified and I would turn into the Tasmanian devil and I would be on fire, like comedically, you know, but that wasn't every time. But I just thought it was like a funny thing and people knew, uh-oh, Bethany's getting stoned. I mean, literally that's what people would say. I don't know anybody else who was spoken about, or at least that I know, when it comes to weed, but it's just so telling, you know, it's like, I wanted that shit and I did not feel that way about alcohol. And it felt so justifiable for me to say, well, yeah, I'm not going to drink. That shit's bad for me. And I don't really want it anyways, but I need to smoke if I'm going to go out to this bar and do this and do that. And I used to be so social before I ever smoked. But then once I just started going at it for several years, it became a crutch for sure. Anyhow, I'm gonna ask you this last question here. Is there anything that you, Claire, would like to express in general in terms of either self-help or mental health or addiction that just feels good for you to share now? I mean, doesn't, you know, anybody could be listening. People who might know stuff, people who don't. I realize that's kind of a big thing to ask. This is very impromptu.
Well, it's a broad, it's got, you know, like, where do I go? Like, there's so many mm-hmm. ways to answer this, mm-hmm. right? So what was the question again? No, just kidding. You know, I think I'm really like struggling. What was the question? What is anything to share around?
Yeah.
Say it, well, one more time.
It was still a little too broad. I said, is there anything that you would like to express in general in terms of self-help, mental health, or addiction that you think that people, how about this, that people might misjudge or preconceived notions? Okay. Here's one. Somebody, I have heard people say, you know, these, you know, AA or MA or whatever, you know, these meetings are really kind of like being in a cult, the whole cult thing. And of course that drives me up a wall because, you know, nobody's being manipulated or forced into anything. But could you just maybe shed a little light on that?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I don't even know how to answer that. First of all, I mean, the reason I don't know how to answer is because there is an answer. And I've heard people say it before. It's like, we're not asking, you know, this fellowship doesn't ask for anything from you, right? It's there. Like, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. That's the only thing that you're required to have if you want to be involved in a 12-step program, right? That's it. Nobody's asking you for, you know, if you want to put a dollar in the basket to pay for some cookies and some coffee every week and to, you know, pay for the room rental, do it. If you don't have the money, you're not required. You know, no one's trying to change no one can change your perception except for you. And there is no, you know, the only thing that we subscribe to in this program is that, you know, there, that we have a method. We have 12 steps. Let's put it that way. And the 12 steps are a journey that if you're interested in taking it, you can examine the behaviors and your, you know, character so that you can assess whether or not you are behaving or thinking in a way that does not serve you and the people that you love. And if you decide that there are things that you are thinking and doing, you know, in ways that you're behaving and feelings that you're having that no longer serve you, then there is an alternative way to live. And that's really what the 12-step recovery is. It's that, you know, you get an opportunity to just examine who you are, who you want to be, and if your actions and are not aligned with who that is, your values, you have an opportunity to shift and change that. So if I were to say one thing, like, if you're at all curious about what this program has to offer, and this is no like sales pitch or anything, it's just like, just go to a meeting, just experience it, right? We talk a lot about addicts tend to have this thing called contempt before investigation, right? They're like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. No, 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 no. You don't have to say yes to anything. You just have to stop saying no if you want to experience something new. And that applies to anything in your life, right? You know, right? So, you know, this is the inherent problem with addiction is that, you know, we tend to think that we know everything. We have the all-knowing kind of, you know, personality. And the truth is, you know, staying open and out of the result of things and just trying new things for the sake of trying new things, trying on new ways of behaving and thinking, you know, is really, can be a really exciting journey. Especially if you're an artist, which I think that the reason I say that is because I was just listening to this Brené Brown, you know, artists are changing the world right now. And, you know, who can better bring a message of like injustice and, you know, to the public than people who are artists. So if you're an artist and you want to like experience what it's like to like, you know, really tap into your creativity and you feel like you're struggling with addiction, you know, show up. Or anyone else who feels like, you know, just experience it and then you can make a decision.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's what I have to say. I mean, I, you know, I'm just a chick in an apartment in LA trying to live my life.
I just realized something. This full hour accidentally wasn't recorded. So if you don't mind, I'm gonna go back to the beginning. And if we can just start with why are you so okay, awesome? No. Listen, this has been really wonderful and super illuminating, I'm sure, for those who are listening. And I've been wanting to do a full episode on my own experience with MA, and I had a lot of hesitancy. I didn't want to do it a disservice. And, you know, thank you for being so thank you for being vulnerable and open and eloquent and funny and for being my sponsor, because, you know, truth be told, you know, and I tell Claire this every time, but we, you know, we have a call weekly and we, you know, sometimes talk and, you know, we text and we'll send each other gratitude lists and, you know, and it's just so, oh my God, I just feel so supported. It feels just so good to have so much support with, you know, with you, with somebody who understands me on so many different levels, right? And whom I can really tell anything to, because one of the points of course, recovery are, you know, sharing your shit. You know, what do they say? You're only as sick as your secrets. Is that correct?
Yeah, they do. You know, step one is honesty, right? Step one is like, you know, admitting that you're powerless over, you know, drugs or alcohol and that your life is unmanageable. And unmanageability is like relative, right? Because like we talked about earlier in this podcast, you know, some people don't see their lives in an unmanageable way until they actually move into or choose to move into sobriety and recovery, because I can tell you that, like, the farther away I am from my addiction, the more insane it looks and unmanageable it looks. But honesty is really the first step. And, you know, when you live in honesty, you know, it really mitigates, well, I would just go as far as alleviates, you know, emotional pain. Like, if you don't, you know, our character liabilities, the things that work against us, are the things that are continuing to cause us all this pain. Yes. So the more we get away from those and more we set those aside, the more free we become.
I couldn't agree more with that. Goddamn. Blair, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
My pleasure. I love you. I can't wait to love see you again in person. And thank you thank you for being my higher power. I'm kidding. That's an inside joke.
I'll just say this. It's my pleasure to be your all knowing God.
I'm getting your name tattooed on my left butt cheek on Friday. So.
That's Self-Help Ideas and Thoughts with Bethany. Oh, that was a good ending, you dickhead.